Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. As you've been hearing on the news this morning, the exile leader of Hamas is visiting Gaza for the first time ever today to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Hamas and celebrate what Hamas sees as a string of recent military and diplomatic victories. We now have a chance to talk to the head of an organization that works on the ground in Gaza, advocating for an easing of economic sanctions on the region and greater freedom of travel for Gazans. Sari Bashi is head of Gisha, that's the Hebrew word for access, and she's visiting the U.S. all this week. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So by way of background about you first, you work in Gaza, but you're Israeli. You were educated here in the United States. Tell us more about your background and what your organization does.
Sure. I'm a lawyer educated at Yale Law School, and for the last 7 years, I've been founding and heading Gisha, which is an Israeli human rights organization that promotes the right to freedom of movement. So our offices are based in Tel Aviv. We provide legal assistance to people in Gaza who need permits from the Israeli military in order to travel. And we also engage in broader advocacy work to encourage policies that are protective of Israeli security, but respective of Palestinian human rights.
Do you have a reaction to the big news of today, which is that exiled Hamas leader Khaled Mashal arrived in Gaza for the first time? How significant is that?
You know, I think things are changing on the ground in a way that is absolutely stunning. And there are a lot of opportunities for Israel. There are also a lot of concerns, obviously. But we see that Hamas is grounding itself as a government in Gaza. We see that the Egyptian regime is taking a very active and in many ways constructive role. And I think that with all the concerns that change brings, there's also a chance right now for Israel to come to a different kind of arrangement regarding Gaza that protects Israeli security interests and maybe cracks down on some of the weapons smuggling, but also allows ordinary people in Gaza to have a better chance at ordinary life.
So you wrote us before the show that some restrictions are aimed at protecting concrete security interests. Others block travel of people and goods in ways that are difficult to understand from a security point of view. One of the examples you sent us, soccer players are allowed to travel from Gaza to the West Bank for national tournaments, but poets participating in national competitions are banned.
Right. So some people think poetry can be dangerous, but I actually think that decisions about who gets to travel should be based on whether there's security risk emanating from that particular individual and not whether they're a poet or a soccer player.
Soccer games start riots, but not revolutions.
That is a very good point. You're absolutely correct.
Up to 100, this is another example, up to 100 senior male merchants are allowed to travel from Gaza to Israel and the West Bank each day. But junior business women, such as female salon owners from Gaza trying to attend a hairdresser's convention in the West Bank, were banned. What was that about?
Yeah, and it's a great example of the kind of restriction that is not responsive to any kind of security interest, and many Israelis are actually saying is bad for Israel in the long term security-wise, because the policy allows access between Gaza and the West Bank for individuals only under exceptional humanitarian circumstances, and also for senior male merchants who are purchasing goods in the West Bank and Israel. But when a businesswoman, like the salon owners, wants to further her economic development and frankly provide for her family and help increase women's participation in the economy in Gaza, the answer is no, because she's not considered senior enough and her case is not considered humanitarian enough. So that's a bit of a short-sighted approach to security. She poses no danger via Israel. And certainly some people think that women's economic empowerment is great for long-term stability.
And one more. Tomatoes can transit from Gaza through Israel and the West Bank en route to Saudi Arabia, but the tomato truck cannot unload in Israel or the West Bank, where demand and profitability are probably higher.
Sure. So in addition to banning people from traveling, Israel is banning people from Gaza from selling their goods in Israel or the West Bank, where the markets are. So Israel is allowing limited quantities of export abroad, and the goods actually come in via Israel. So they undergo all Israeli security checks. There's no security problem. But the decision is not to allow people in Gaza to actually market them in Israel or the West Bank, which is preventing the agricultural and industrial sectors in Gaza from revitalizing and keeping unemployment at about about a third of the workforce.
My guest on WNYC is Sari Bashi, the head of Gisha, Israeli word for access, and she's visiting the U.S. all this week on behalf of more freedom of movement economic goods for the people of Gaza. She's an Israeli activist for that. I imagine the actual halt to live fire is the most significant element of the ceasefire. But are there other elements to the recent negotiation that relate to the economy that also affect the daily lives of Gazans?
I certainly hope so. One of the provisions in the ceasefire agreement is an agreement by Israel under Egyptian brokerage to negotiate easings in the travel restrictions. And already we've seen two changes on the ground. One is that Israel has expanded the fishing limits off the coast of Gaza. Fishermen can now travel up to 6 nautical miles as opposed to 3. The second change is that Israel maintains a buffer zone inside Gaza but near the Israeli border fence, which is a no-go zone that contains about a third of Gaza's arable land. So since the ceasefire negotiations, Israel is allowing farmers to work their land up to 100 miles of the border fence, and that is very helpful. However, there is Egyptian commitment to negotiating even further easings, and there we think that the Egyptians can play a really positive role in, on the one hand, providing arrangements that can maybe crack down on some of the smuggling and also come to regional arrangements with Israeli involvement, but at the same time lift some of those sillier restrictions on the tomatoes and the poets.
Do you think sanctions can ever be effective as a diplomatic tool?
You know, I would question the use of the word sanctions when we talk about Gaza, because sanctions tend to be used by one country against another country when you're sort of far away. And then what you're doing is withholding something that is your sovereign right to do. We choose not to trade. What's happening in Gaza is that Israel is actually controlling the borders. And so it's not just saying we choose not to trade with Gaza. It's preventing every country in the world from trading. And more significantly, preventing people from Gaza who are Palestinian from accessing the other part of the Palestinian territory, which is the West Bank. So I think we call it a framework of the law of occupation, where there are different sets of responsibilities that are actually greater than sanctions.
Let's talk about, I want to get your take on some of the other major developments recently, and there have been some very major developments. How significant for the average Gazan do you think it is that Palestine gained non-member status at the UN last week?
You know, I think the statehood issue doesn't lead to anything immediate on the ground. And a lot of it is a question of what we do from here, where we go. Nothing has changed in terms of Israeli military occupation. Within the West Bank, there's still a direct military presence. Within Gaza, there still is control over access for people and goods. The question is whether Palestine as a state, as opposed to as a territory, will be able to negotiate better access arrangements and a sort of a better future for its people. And there, I think, both Israel and the United States can play a very constructive role. Up until now, there's been a lot of threatening to sanction the PA for going for statehood. But I do think that one thing to remember about statehood is that a two-state solution includes a Palestinian state. So there could also be opportunities here.
I imagine that you're no fan of the Netanyahu government's reaction to the UN vote, which was to expand settlements in the West Bank.
I mean, I think that's not helpful. The Netanyahu government may go back on that by the end of the elections, because we're in an elections period. There's a lot of things that are being announced for public domestic consumption. And, you know, the building in E1, which is where the settlement expansion was announced, has been announced many times. Mm. And thus far, it hasn't taken place. Mm. I think that would be useful if it didn't take place. But I also think the United States has a role to play here in kind of making clear U.S. policy that settlements are an obstacle to peace and therefore they shouldn't take place.
Do you think that's not clear? That got the Obama administration in so much trouble with Netanyahu before.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in both cases, in Israel and the United States, we're very close to elections. And so it remains to be seen what the new Obama administration does. And it remains to be seen what a new government or a new Netanyahu government will do after the elections. I do think that once the elections die down, people behave more rationally. The Netanyahu government, I will say that they have actually done more to ease restrictions on freedom of movement than the previous Olmert government. And there's been some encouraging comments from the Netanyahu government about wanting to, on the one hand, protect Israeli security, but on the other hand, allow civilian access. And so we hope that practice will meet the rhetoric.
My guest for another few minutes, Sari Bashi, the head of the group Gisha, the Hebrew word for access. She's an activist in Israel for more freedom of movement for people and goods on the ground in Gaza, and she's visiting the U.S. all this week. On our comments page right now from a listener, someone writes, today's New York Times seems to state that Fatah has settled into the diplomatic corps of the Palestinian movement and Hamas the military, with the two possibly settling into that arrangement. Do you agree with that take?
You know, I think the Hamas regime in Gaza is also a movement and also a government. And certainly the flood of Arab diplomats entering Gaza during the war, which, by the way, is a precedent that was caused by the recent escalation of violence, suggests that Hamas is also playing an important diplomatic role. And, you know, many of my colleagues within Gaza, Palestinian human rights activists, have been pushing the Hamas regime to behave more like a government and less like a movement, including taking responsibility for providing for the population and also respecting international law, including in its warfare vis-a-vis Israel. So not targeting civilians, not putting rockets in civilian population centers, and behaving responsibly.
So you're concerned, as an Israeli, I'm sure, that Hamas is now developing and apparently willing to use rockets that can go all the way to Tel Aviv, all the way to Jerusalem.
Sure. I found myself for the first time last month lying on my stomach with my hands over my head at a Tel Aviv train station because for the first time in 4 decades, rockets were fired on Tel Aviv. And that's scary. And I think it shows that Israel is vulnerable and Israel needs to make regional arrangements that acknowledge that vulnerability. There is not a military solution to what's going on right now. We need to enter into different kinds of arrangements with our neighbors so that they can be okay, their societies can function in a healthy way, and we can also be okay and safe.
How are average residents of Gaza viewing Mohamed Morsi's power grab in Egypt, which of course came just one day after he helped broker the ceasefire and negotiate on behalf of Hamas with Israel and the U.S.?
Yeah, it seems he's a great foreign policymaker and a less successful domestic policymaker. I mean, certainly people in Gaza are concerned about what's happening, especially because Egypt is such an important broker for people in Gaza. And I think what they're mostly hoping is that Morsi will take care of his own house and figure out the domestic situation so that he can go back to playing a better role, a constructive role vis-a-vis Israel and Gaza.
And did they actually see Morsi as on their side? Because one analysis of how that ceasefire came about is that Morsi and Obama agreed that they were each going to say really supportive things about their side, Obama about Israel, Morsi about Hamas, but then they were each going to restrain their clients. And so in a way, he was working to restrain Hamas rather than empower them.
And it's a great analysis because one of the things that was interesting in listening to what the Egyptian prime minister said during his visit in Gaza during the recent escalation was on the one hand to express solidarity with the Palestinian people, on the other hand to affirm Egypt's regional role in creating a secure and stable situation with Israel. And I think that there, people within Gaza recognize the importance of Egypt and they're sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place, Israel on one end, Egypt on the other. And so they understand that Egypt is not going to be opening the border in an unrestricted way, but they are hoping that Egypt will play a role in actually pushing Israel to open Gaza West Bank access, which is important for folks in Gaza.
So last thing, do people see the mass protests in Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab world as a model for a grassroots uprising against the more extremist elements of Hamas? Could Gazan protests against their own government happen? Because after all, it's not just Israel. I think we could say that Hamas has been a stunning failure in many respects with respect to increasing the economic viability of life in Gaza for Gazans.
So within the West Bank, Gaza and Israel, there have been protests based on social justice issues against all the governments. And I think the protests have been more about the economy and people's ordinary life than any greater political change thus far. Within Gaza, a lot of those protests have been repressed. And I think there's more work to be done in terms of allowing them to take place in a healthier way. And also within the Hamas regime, there's a range. There are people who are harder line, and there are people who are actually quite moderate, who would like to see Gaza have a more pragmatic approach.
Is it just that Israel is seen as such a powerful oppressor by people in Gaza that protesting against the oppressor, you know, the oppression of their own Hamas regime is just seen as small potatoes?
You know, the Hamas regime has actually been preventing people in Gaza from protesting against Israel by approaching the border fence so that there are, in cases when people did want to come closer to Israeli soldiers on the other side, the police took a role in preventing that. For people in Gaza, you know, they're 85% refugees. They're from inside Israel, and many of them dream of coming back. And so it's a difficult situation for them to be closed up in Gaza. And I think that any attempt to assure Israeli security should take into account also their needs. needs and think about how is it possible to, on the one hand, protect against threats for Israel, but on the other hand, allow ordinary people in Gaza to lead ordinary lives.
Sari Bashi is the head of Gisha. She is visiting the U.S. all this week. Thank you very much. A great conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next is Joe Loda, head of the MTA, the new Hillary Clinton. We'll explain that, what that question means, coming up in a minute.